welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again. And welcome back. We are now in Virginia. We're in the Virginia Ratification Debates. Now, last time I went through the Ratification Debates, which was last year, and every time I do this, I go through this, you know, live, or, you know, it's all new. I don't, you know, just replay the same thing. So going through this again this year, we will probably, because last year I think it took about 2 weeks to get through Virginia. There's all, in all likelihood, because of some of the things that are going on, I've highlighted, I want you to understand that as they debated the Constitution, they went to ad nauseum in Virginia. They spent days on just the militia, martial law, and those types of things. And so I'm only giving you the highlights, but there's that much meat in the Virginia ratification debates. I just want to be very clear. And again, when we talk about who is talking, most people have heard of these names. Patrick Henry is the anti-federalist, the guy that was trying to kill the Constitution. If you look at, you know, Mr. Madison, the father of the Constitution, this is where he was at. George Mason, right? We've got George Mason. We've got Governor Randolph here. We've got Pendleton. We've got Nicholas. I mean, there is, it's almost like the who's who. And there's this up-and-comer called Mr. Corbyn, who was a Federalist, and he was very young. He was a huge fan of Mr. Madison. And, I mean, he kind of, when I say fan, he was fanatic. He was very impressed by Mr. Madison. And so he actually, at one point in this debates, and we'll probably get to that, and I'll point it out, that he actually offended Mr. Henry, where Mr. Henry makes a big show and a mockery of him instead of challenging him to go out and duel. Because when you get to that point, and if you read through the procedures, they really point out that you cannot disrespect anybody in, you know, your addressing of the audience and what have you. Anyway, because they took this stuff very seriously. Anyway, as you know, this is the only show that provides you with this kind of data. When I am done with this, we started on the 29th of March. When I am done with this, you will have hours and hours and hours that if you put these things together into a playlist, it'll be almost like you read the ratification debates yourself without actually going through all of the ratification debates, because I've kind of done the heavy lifting for you, because I've highlighted the most important parts, or the parts that really, you know, that sends the message home. Now, again, I'm going to try to avoid the anti-federalist comments. I'm going to try to, but sometimes I can't, because like Mr. Mason, when he starts talking about martial law and so forth, he kind of helps the argument, but more important, he helps the argument for the Federalists, but more importantly, what he does is he lays out exactly how they will violate the Constitution if they want to get rid of the militia, which is what they did. And so his insights were very clear. Had people, you know, were familiar with the ratification debates and they saw what the federal government was doing, they would have said, hey, you know, we're going down this real dangerous path that we're going to not have a militia anymore, and we're going to be so outside the boundaries of the Constitution that it won't even be funny. And that's the beginning of the terror of tyranny. So anyway, and I'll point it all out to you so that you understand in context how this is all happening. Thank you for tuning in. We've got our comment line, 425-270-5416. And without any further ado, Mr. Randolph, or Governor Randolph, gets up and says, I am afraid I have tired the patience of this House, but I trust you will pardon me, as I was urged by the importunity of the gentleman in calling for the reasons of laying the groundwork of this plan. It is objected by the honorable gentleman over the way, Mr. Mason, that a Republican government is impracticable to the extensive territory and the extent of the United States. Now, this is where they get into Montesquieu and how Montesquieu said, you can't have a republic of this size. But Montesquieu did not fathom a constitutional republic that had defined enumerated powers. So anyway, Mr. Randolph, or Governor Randolph, continues and says, states is urged as a reason for the rejection of this constitution. Let us consider the definition of a republican government as laid down by a man who is highly esteemed. Montesquieu, so celebrated among public or politicians, says that, quote, a republican government is that in which the body or only a part of the people is possessed of the supreme power. A monarchical, that in which a single person governs by fixed and established laws. A despotic government, that in which a single person without law and without rule directs everything by his own will and caprice, close quote. This author has not distinguished a republican government from a monarchy by the extent of its boundaries, but by the nature of its principles. He, in another place, contradistinguishes it as a government of laws in opposition to others, which he demonstrates a government of men. The empire of government of laws, according to that phrase, is in which the laws are made with the free will of the people. Hence, then, if laws be made by the assent of the people, the government may be deemed free. Well, he's now describing a democracy. When laws are made with integrity and executed with wisdom, the question is whether a great extent of country will tend to abridge the liberty of people. If defensive forces be necessary in proportion to the extent of the country, I conceive that in a judiciously constructed government, be the country ever so extensive, its inhabitants will be proportionably numerous and able to defend it. Extent of country, in my conception, ought to be no bar to the adoption of a good government. No extent on earth seems to be too great, provided the laws be wisely made and executed. The principles of representation and responsibility may pervade a large as well as small territory, and tyranny is as easily introduced into a small as into a large district. If it be answered that some of the most illustrious and distinguished authors are of a contrary opinion, I reply, that author has no weight with me till I am convinced that not the dignity of name, but the force of reasoning gains my assent. Okay, so that's what his point was. And I'm going to tell you, they cited Montesquieu during the constitutional debates as well as the ratification debates. I mean, you know, when somebody starts talking about a republic that can only be of a small size, then this really becomes a huge argument. And this is how they were able to create such a constrained federal government by the enumeration of powers instead of general powers. Anyway, this is Mr. Madison, and it starts off with, this is what it says in the ratification debates. Mr. Madison rose, but he spoke so low that his exordium could not be heard distinctly until this point. I shall now attempt to make impressions by my ardent professions of zeal for the public welfare. We know the principles of every man will and ought to be judged not by his profession and declarations, but by his conduct. By that criterion, I mean, in common with every other member to be judged. And should it prove unfavorable to my reputation, yet it is a criterion from which I will by no means depart. The comparisons have been made between the friends of this Constitution and those who oppose it. I kind of prefer the enemies. Anyway, although I disapprove of such comparisons, I trust that in a point of truth, honor, candor, and rectitude of motives, the friends of this system here and in other states are not inferior to its opponents. My professions of attachment to the public good and comparisons of the parties ought not to govern the influence of us now. We ought, sir, to examine the Constitution on its own merits solely. We are to inquire whether it will promote the public happiness. Its aptitude to produce this desirable object ought to be the exclusive subject of our present research. In this pursuit, we ought not to address our arguments to the feelings and passions, but those understandings and judgments which were selected by the people of this country to decide. This great question by a calm, or to decide this great question by a calm and rational investigation. I thought that was a period, but it was a comma. I hope that gentlemen in displaying, wow, it's really hard to read that when you say, because you don't speak that way anymore. I hope that gentlemen in displaying their abilities on this occasion, instead of giving opinions and making assertions, will condescend to prove and demonstrate by a fair and regular discussion. It gives me pain to hear gentlemen continually distorting the natural construction of language. For it is sufficient if any human production can stand a fair discussion, but I proceed to make some additions to the reasons which we have adduced by my honorable friend over the way. I must take the liberty to make some observations on what he had said by another gentleman, Mr. Henry. He told us that this Constitution ought to be rejected because it endangered the public liberty, in his opinion, in many instances. And we will stop right there. So you can already see, you know, Madison has pointed out the tenor or the tone that Mr. Henry has already put out there, that it this thing needs to be rejected. And they didn't even get into, I didn't see anywhere where, I know that they did actually vote on the over exceeding the commissions, because Paula Mayer was the one that put it in her book. But anyway, we'll be right back after these two messages.
Taking the time to watch our presentation on YouTube that provided an irrefutable argument of what we have to do to save our Constitution and our Republic. I know it's over an hour and 30 minutes, but you only need to watch the first 30 minutes. If you take the time to watch this presentation, I promise it will change your paradigm regarding what our Constitution is and what we have to do if we are going to save it, our liberties, our sovereignty, and our republic. We already have answers to most of the questions that you might think of after watching this presentation, and we want to help you get to a point where you have a profound understanding of the audit and republic review process. This is why our bullet overview and flowchart of both the argument and process is available on reclaimingtherepublic.org. The sooner you get informed, the sooner you can get involved and make an impact. So go to reclaimingtherepublic.org to the Take Action page. That's where you'll find the video. Thank you so much.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review, as well as my description of the republic review model, on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how republic review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.
Friends, if you have any questions or comments, we have our 24-hour comment line at 425-270-5416.
Okay, so Madison goes on, and there's a lot of meat right in this, right up front. He throws out a lot of things. And so he basically continues and says, "Give me leave to make one answer to that observation. Let the dangers which this system is supposed to be replete with be clearly pointed out. If any dangerous and unnecessary powers be given to the general legislature, let them be plainly demonstrated. And let us not rest satisfied with general assertions of danger without examination." So in other words,
you know, like the John Birch Society with the Convention of States. Oh, well, the first one was a general assertion. That's bad and incorrect. And the way they basically go about it could be a runaway, or they could abuse their powers. That's not a sufficient argument. The fact is that the problem is not the Constitution. There is no zero justification in calling for amending the Constitution. Even the Convention of State folks state that the problem is encroachments. Well, what do you do when it's encroachments? You don't call for amending the Constitution because that's not the problem. The federal government is out of control. And that is why interposition with what Madison called for. So anyway, he also says, if powers be necessary, apparent danger is not sufficient reason against conceding them. He has suggested that licentiousness has seldom produced the loss of liberty, but that the tyranny of rulers has almost always affected it. So this is where he starts talking, and this one is about encroachments. Since the general civilization of mankind, I believe that there are more instances of the abridgment of the freedom of the people by gradual and silent encroachments of those in power than by violent and sudden usurpations. But on a candid examination of history, we shall find that turbulence, violence, and the abuse of power by the majority trampling on the rights of the minority have produced factions and commotions which in republics have more frequently than any other cause produced despotism. If we go over the whole history of the ancient and modern republics, we shall find their destruction to have generally resulted from those causes. Now I want to point out that what we see today, when we see that, you know, there's all of these people out in the street demanding social justice and all, that does not mean that that is the sentiment of the majority of the people in America. What they're doing is they're constantly using hyperbolic speech. They're using fear mongering and all of these other, all this other rhetoric to get people to kind of believe. And by getting people, by repeating the lie and the lie and the lie, this actually comes down to, because Larry Elder pointed out the other day, you know, how many in, I think it was 2020, how many blacks were killed by a police officer with a shooting? How many blacks were shot by a police officer? And majority of all of the answers were like, you know, 1 to 5,000, 5,000 to 10,000. They were really, you know, up there. And one of the answers was 1 to 30. Well, it was 1 to 30. And he points out that because people have been hearing in the news of blacks being shot by police, they believe the bigger number. But it's not like they've been talking about different cases. They just go on and on and on and on. So people basically deduce, and they hear these people with the BLM and all these others, you know, just complaining about all the black abuse and the deaths caused at the hands of police, when the reality is it's really not that case. That's not the truth. But people believe it. So that's how we get disjoined from reality. And that's how, because people haven't been taught to critically think, they do not understand, you know, what's happening, you know, in reality to what they're being told, and they just buy into the narrative. And they believe that that is the truth, and they believe that that is a real problem, when it really isn't. Anyway, Madison now, I skipped down a little bit, and he now starts talking about exclusive legislation. And Madison says this: he objects to the exclusive legislation over the district where the seat of government may be fixed. Would he submit that the representatives of the state should carry on their deliberations under the control of any other member of the union? If any state had the power of legislation over the place where Congress should fit the general government, this would impair the dignity and hazard the safety of Congress. If the safety of the Union were under the control of any particular state, would not foreign corruption probably prevail in such a state to induce it to exert its controlling influence over the members of the general government? Gentlemen cannot have forgotten the disgraceful insult which Congress received some years ago, when we also reflect that the previous session of particular states is necessary before Congress can legislate exclusively anywhere, we must, instead of being alarmed at this part, heartily approve it. He goes on and says this, but the honorable member sees great danger in the provision concerning the militia. This I conceive to be an additional security to our liberty without disarming the power of the states in any considerable degree. It appears to me so highly expedient that I should imagine it would have found advocates even in the warmest friends of the present system. The authority of the training the militia and appointing the officers is reserved to the states. Congress ought to have the power to establish a uniform discipline throughout the states and provide for the execution of the laws, suppress insurrections, and repel invasions. Now, this uniform discipline goes into, you know, what type of guns and ammo, because if you have if the militia just allowed everybody to just go buy their favorite gun, there would be no uniformity in ammo. How could they maintain that much of an arsenal? That's why they said, okay, this is the weapon of choice, the AR or the M16, A1, A2, the M15. And so that's what was the general issue. The same with the sidearm. It used to be the 45 Colt, and then it went to the 9mm. Now, some services started changing so that they could have some unique things, but that actually flies in the face of uniformity. And that's why thiefdoms, basically in the Department of Defense, one will find these thiefdoms that are created where they try to create their own, you know, separate controls so that they don't have to share or something that they believe is better, what have you. Anyway, moving on, Madison says, these are the only cases wherein they can interfere with the militia, and the obvious necessity of their having power over them in these cases must convince any reflecting mind. Without uniformity of discipline, military bodies would be incapable of action. Without a general controlling power to call forth the strength of the Union to repel invasions. Ooh, there you go. So if we have an invasion going on our southern border, the militia must be called forth. The country might be overrun and conquered by foreign enemies without such a power to suppress insurrections. Our liberties might be destroyed by domestic faction and domestic tyranny be established. Now, he goes on and talks a little bit about how nations lose their liberties. And he says, the honorable member then told us that there was no instance of power once transferred being voluntarily renounced, not to produce European examples, which may probably be done before the rising of this convention. Have we not already seen in 7 states and probably in an 8th state legislatures surrendering some of the most important powers they possessed? But, sir, by this government, powers are not given to any particular set of men. They are in the hands of the people, delegated to their representatives chosen for short terms, to representatives responsible to the people and whose situation is perfectly familiar to their own. As long as this is the case, we have no danger to apprehend. When the gentleman called our recollection to the usual effects of the concessions of power and imputed the loss of liberty generally to open tyranny, I wish he had gone farther. Upon the review of history, he would have found that the loss of liberty very often resulted from factions and divisions, from local considerations, which eternally led to quarrels. He would have found internal dissensions to have more frequently demolished civil liberty than a tenacious disposition in rulers to retain any stipulated powers. Now, in the same address, I go for a few paragraphs, and then he starts talking about jurisdiction. I confess to you, sir, were uniformity of religion to be introduced by this system, it would be, in my opinion, ineligible. But I have no reason to conclude that uniformity of government will produce that of religion. This subject is for the honor of America, perfectly free and unshackled. The government has no jurisdiction over it. The least reflection will convince us that there is no danger to be feared on this ground. But we are flattered with the probability of obtaining previous amendments. This calls for the most serious attention of the House. If amendments are proposed by one state, other states have the same right and will also propose alterations. Now, see, I want you to understand here that what he's talking about is that states should be and would be active in calling for amendments to the Constitution. Now, he's not saying here that states are applying for an Article 5 convention. They're just being active and telling the government, we need this amendment. Isn't that interesting? There we go. Because the problem isn't the Constitution. The problem is that they want to delegate more power, what have you. We'll be right back after these two promos. Thank you so much.
Reclaiming the Republic is more than an educational radio show. My intent is to also work with you and local leadership to promote matters of the Constitution and self-governance. This way we can all promote constitutional awareness within our communities and with our elected officials and public leaders. If you love liberty and sovereignty and recognize the federal tyranny that is threatening our lives, then we are asking for your help. And here are a few ways you can help. Spread the word about this radio show, Reclaiming the Republic. It is the only radio show in the world asserting a constitutional solution to federal overreach. Download and share our podcasts and content. Read, like, follow, and share our Mobiusstrip Press and Reclaiming the Republic pages on Facebook. Follow us on Twitter at Mobiusstrip News. Get informed about local groups in the area and get involved. Most importantly, become a constitutional warrior with your local leaders and demand that they begin applying constitutional tests to what they are doing and who they are supporting. Thank you. To become a citizen, one must take an oath to support and defend the Constitution. Those of us who are naturally born citizens are obligated and duty-bound to fulfill the same oath even though we're not required to take it because it is implied upon us at birth. This is why I cannot emphasize enough the importance in supporting businesses who are supporting our Constitution. We have to stop supporting businesses that have chosen to hide behind political correctness, and obviously we must stop supporting progressive businesses who are working to undermine our republic and our Constitution. Do not let businesses or organizations convince you that they are supporting the Constitution by supporting protests for social justice. By definition, social justice is the distribution of wealth, opportunities, and privileges within a society. In other words, they're calling for socialism, which is incompatible with individual liberty and individual sovereignty and our Constitution. With that, please consider supporting businesses who advertise on this show and this radio station.
Don't forget, you can call our 24-hour comment line to ask a question or to speak on any topic. Dial 425-270-5416.
Okay, so now, again, he's kind of shifted on jurisdiction, then shifted into the amendments and the powers that the states have in calling for amendments and making these changes and so forth. And then after this, we're going to get into enumerated jurisdiction. But anyway, but we are flattered with the probability of obtaining previous amendments. This calls for the most serious attention of this House. If amendments are to be proposed by one state, other states have the same right and will also propose alterations. This cannot but be dissimilar and opposite in the nature. I beg leave to remark that the governments of the different states are in many respects dissimilar in their structure. Their legislative bodies are not similar. Their executive are more different. In several of the states, the first magistrate is elected by the people at large. In others, by joint ballot of the members of both branch of the legislature. And in others, in another different manners, this dissimilarity has occasioned a diversity of opinion on the theory of government, which will, without many reciprocal concessions, render a concurrence impossible. although the appointment of an executive magistrate has not been thought destructive to the principles of a democracy in many of the states, yet in the course of the debate, we find objections made to the federal executive. It is urged that the president will denigrate into a tyrant. I intend, in compliance with the call of the honorable member, to explain the reasons of proposing this constitution and develop its principles, but I shall postpone my remarks till we hear the supplement which he has informed us he intends to add what he has already said. So, interestingly enough, what we have here is a kind of a change of, you know, talking about the states and how the states were different. So here's a snapshot. Here's a snapshot of the states of how the legislatures and even the executives were being selected, that they weren't uniform. So why is it that way now? Because when people realized how good this Constitution was, every state basically kind of, for the most part, copied it. And they, you know, maintained their own powers, or I should say the people, because some of these states, like North Carolina, already had their own Bill of Rights. So some of those states maintained those. But every state in the Union went into convention and modeled their legislative bodies to become bicameral with representations of the people and representations of the county. That was the Senate, the county, the people being a county as well. So each county was guaranteed a representative and a senator, at least one representative. The more popular, or I should say populated, counties had more representatives, just like how the states were being done in their apportionment, representation, and so forth under this Constitution. This is how we can start seeing how this Constitution and the paradigms that was injected into society. I mean, paradigms that couldn't even be fathomed, this concept of dual sovereignty, that the people would have their own representative and that the states or the counties would have their own representative. This bicameral legislative body was completely unique and different. And as I pointed out, in the House of Lords, that was representations of the people, the House of Commons was a representation of the people, and the House of Lords was an aristocracy. In other words, they didn't have representations that were representing the states. It was strictly the lords and the barons and all of these highfalutin men were maintaining their influence over the House of Lords. So this is why, you know, in our system, how states, just think, had America had representations of each colony in Parliament, in the House of Lords, or actually we call it the Senate, there probably would never have been the Revolutionary War, and we would all be part of the English kingdom still. That's how dramatic these changes really were and how people recognized the security of their liberty. Anyway, enumerated jurisdiction. Mr. Madison goes on and says, "Give me leave to say something of the nature of government and to show that it is safe and just to vest it with the power of taxation. There are a number of opinions, but the principal question is whether it be a federal or consolidated government. In order to judge properly of the question before us, we must consider it minutely in its principal parts. I conceive myself that it is a mixed nature." That's why I call it a hybrid republic or hybrid constitution republic. It is in a manner unprecedented. We cannot find one express example in the experience of the whole world. It stands by itself. In some respects, it is a government of a federal nature. In others, it is of a consolidated nature. Even if we attended to the manner in which the Constitution is investigated, ratified, and made the act of the people of America, I can say, notwithstanding that the honorable gentleman has alleged that this government is not completely solid, consolidated, nor is it entirely federal. Now, this is where, because that person that made that assertion was Patrick Henry. And Patrick Henry was basically saying, hey, we see this as a consolidated government moving us into a democracy. It starts off with we the people. And this is where Madison is now addressing this whole, what kind of government is this, and so forth. And this is what he says regarding we the people. Madison states, who are the parties to it? The people, but not the people as composing one great body or a consolidated government, but the people as composing 13 sovereignties. Were it, as the gentleman asserts, a consolidated government, the assent of a majority of the people would be sufficient for its establishment. And as a majority have adopted it already, the remaining states would be bound by the act of the majority, even if they unanimously reprobated it or refused it. Were it such a government as is suggested, it would be now binding on the people of this state without having had the privilege of deliberating upon it. But, sir, no state is bound by it, as it is without its own consent. Now, what I'm really pointing out here, and this was also in the North Carolina debates, that states could secede. They could leave. States could come in and they can leave. There is no permanent binding that you have become a slave to the federal government by joining the union. Madison goes on and says, should all the states adopt it, it will be then a government established by 13 states of America, not through the intervention of the legislatures, but by the people at large. In this, but not by the people at large as a democracy, by the way, folks. This was a Republican convention. They didn't send the people of the state to debate this. Everybody selected a delegate, a representative, to go learn about the Constitution and make the decisions for them. They were already thoroughbreds in a Republican form of government. And what I mean by that is they were doing everything by representation. They were not doing anything by a majority rules or anything like that. Anyway, in this particular respect, the distinction between the existing and proposed governments is very material. The existing system has been derived from the dependent derivative authority of the legislatures of the states, whereas this is derived from the superior power of the people. If we look at the manner in which alterations are to be made in it, the same idea in some degree is attended to. By the new system, a majority of states cannot introduce amendments. Okay, by the new system, a majority of the states cannot introduce amendments, nor are all the states required for that purpose. 3/4 of them must concur in alterations. In this, there is a departure from the federal idea. The members to the National House of Representatives are to be chosen by the people at large, in proportion to the numbers of the respective districts. When we come to the Senate, it is members are elected by the states in their equal and political capacity. But had the government been completely consolidated, the Senate would have been chosen by the people in their individual capacity. In their individual capacity, in the same manner as the members of the other house. Thus, it is of a complete consolidated nature. So I don't want to skim over this. This is where he's talking about the differentiation between the Senate and the House of Representatives and how they actually have this division because of the nature of where these men are, where they obtain their authority to become a representative. And I'll read it again. When we come to the Senate, its members are elected by the states in their equal and political capacity. Had the government been completely consolidated, the Senate would have been chosen by the people in their individual capacity in the same manner as the members of the House. Thus, it is of a complicated nature, and this complication, I trust, will found to exclude the evils of absolute consolidation as well as of the mere confederacy. And so we'll talk a little bit about the bicameral legislative body and how these separations were critical. We'll be right back after these two promos.
If you run a business or an organization, you already know email is an essential tool for communicating. If you're interested in reducing your overhead and increasing your productivity, I personally recommend you look into AdLocal email marketing services. AdLocal has a special offer for my listeners with email services that start at $10 a month for your first 1,000 addresses. If you want to increase customer retention, grow your market presence, track your statistics, and improve your engagement with your customers with modern, elegant emails that express the personality of your business with emails that integrate with your website, you need to contact AdLocal, and they handle the rest. Take it from me. AdLocal offers the best solutions for all organization sizes, and they lead with their pricing and the 24-hour customer service. Folks, it's time to call AdLocal at 866-88-ADLOCAL or visit them on the web at www.adlocal.com.
To set the record straight, Republic Review is neither an Article 5 convention nor a convention of states. In accordance with Article 5 of the Constitution, this convention requires 2/3 of the states to apply to Congress to convene a convention with the intent to amend the Constitution. This convention is unable to solve our real problem, which is non-compliance to the Constitution, and would be dangerous to convene at this time. In contrast, Republic Review is the process of the states exerting its constitutional authority over the Constitution. An audit does not require an application to Congress. This authority is inherent to principal stakeholders of a contract. Why do we need Republic Review? Because this is the only way the states can deal with the federal encroachments into roles, responsibilities, and powers that belong to the states. To learn more about Republic Review, please go to reclaimingtherepublic.org to read my content and my model on the audit and Republic Review process.
As a reminder, if you have any questions or comments, we have a 24-hour comment line, 425-270-5416. Okay, so basically Madison is spelling out that if the people elected both the House and the Senate, it would be consolidated and it would be futile to have separate powers because, bottom line, you don't have the influence of the state legislation anymore. Why was it so important for the state legislators to appoint the senators? That way, they could provide guidance to their senators as to whether they should, you know, ratify a treaty, whether they should, you know, reject somebody as a Supreme Court justice, as a department head, or what have you, because the Senate had very unique responsibilities. And those who were in politics of the time, and even today, know people by name, know what's going on more than the average person. By moving it in a consolidated form to where the people elect both, the people really aren't electing both anymore. It's he who has the most power. In other words, Soros is buying the votes because there is no guidance anymore or influence from state legislatures or the people. We're just now it's at a point where we're not even voting. The machines are voting for us. Yeah, you may go and participate in the voting process, but if you have automated like mail-in ballots and those types of things, then you are being played. But only 4 or 5 states have permanent mail-in ballots. If your state is looking to go that way, you need to cut it off immediately because the outcome will be directed by the software and those who control those machines. I've interviewed plenty of people from Washington State where we have this, and they've all pointed to the algorithms as well as the ultimate control behind the scenes, as we have actually seen what happened from Italy in changing votes in some of the elections in the states. Anyway, let me finish up what Madison says here. This is again on June 6th. If Virginia was separated from all the states, her power and authority would extend to all cases in like manner. Were all powers vested in the general government, it would be a consolidated government. But The powers of the federal government are enumerated. It can only operate in certain cases and its legislative powers on defined and limited objects, beyond which it cannot extend its jurisdiction. Boy, in that short sentence, he said a mouthful. As he says, and let me see here, where is... it's basically not even a part of a sentence. It's the second part behind a semicolon. The powers of the federal government are enumerated. This is all they can do. It can only operate in those certain cases. So what did he just say? Can they create this power to give money for welfare or for job security or for unemployment or for food assistance, any type of welfare program? No. If it's not enumerated, they can't do it. And as he said, it cannot operate in it can only operate in certain cases based on those enumerated powers. It has legislative powers on defined and limited objects beyond which it cannot extend its jurisdiction. In that one sentence, or actually a fragment of a sentence, he said a mouthful. He basically said it all. And those paradigms get echoed throughout this whole ratification debate. Now, this is where he gets into some general comments. And this is wrapping it up for Madison for the day, I believe. Let me see here for the day. Yep, because Mr. Nicholas wraps it up for the day. And this is where Mr. Nicholas also talks about martial law. But anyway, let me get into what Madison says. But it is urged that its consolidated nature, joined to the power of a direct taxation, will give a tendency to destroy all subordinate authority. That it has increasing influence will speedily enable it to absorb the state governments. I cannot think this will be the case. If the general government were wholly independent on the governments of the particular states, then indeed usurpation might be expected to the fullest extent. But, sir, on whom does this general government depend? It derives its authority from these governments and from the same sources from which their authority is derived. The members of the federal government are taken from the same men from whom which the state legislators are taken. If we consider the mode in which the federal representatives will be chosen, we shall be conceived that the general will never destroy the individual governments. And this conviction must be strengthened by an attention to the construction of the Senate. Now that's gone by the wayside with the 17th Amendment. Madison says, the representative will be chosen probably under the influence of the members of the state legislatures, but there is not the least probability that the election of the latter will be influenced by the former. 160 members represent this commonwealth in one branch of legislature, are drawn from the people at large, and must ever possess more influence than the few men who will be elected to the general legislature. The reasons offered on this subject by a gentleman on the same side, Mr. Nicholas, were unanswerable and have been so full that I shall not add but little more on the subject. Those who wish to become federal representatives must depend on their credit with that class of men who will be the most popular in their counties. See, he said counties, not legislative districts or congressional districts, counties, who generally represent the people in the state governments. They can therefore never succeed in any measure contrary to the wishes of those on whom they depend. It is almost certain, therefore, that the deliberations of the members of the Federal House of Representatives will be directed to the interest of the people of America. As to the other branch, the senators will be appointed by the legislatures, and though elected for 6 years, I do not conceive they will soon forget the source from whence they derive their political existence. And because of that, the states actually had clout and pull with what the Senate was going to do each day. This election of one this election of one branch of the federal by the state legislatures secures an absolute dependence on the former of the latter. The biennial exclusion of one-third will lessen the facility of a combination and may put a stop to intrigues. I appeal to our past experience whether they will attend to the interest of their constituent states. Have not those gentlemen who have honored with seats in Congress often signalized themselves by their attachment to their seats? I wish this government may answer the expectation of its friends and foil the apprehensions of its enemies. I hope the patriotism of the people will continue and be a sufficient guard to their liberties. I believe its tendencies will be that the state government will counteract the general interest and ultimately prevail. Now, all we need to do is counteract what the federal government is doing, and we will prevail with Republic Review. The number of the representatives is yet sufficient for our safety and will gradually increase. And if we consider the different sources of information, the number will not appear too small. Now, Mr. Nicholas, like I said, he kind of closes up. I got 2 minutes, so I'm going to go ahead and lean into this because this is really good, because he's talking about the powers of the government. And he says, Mr. Chairman, if the resolution taken by the House of going regularly through the system clause by clause had been followed, I should confine myself to one particular paragraph. But as to my surprise, the debates have taken a different turn. I love this because he's poking the anti-federalists because they said, we're going to go through this clause by clause and focus on that clause only. And instead, they're pulling in all of these things, reading ahead and so forth, you know, talking about things, and they just did not follow the clause by clause. So anyway, I think he eloquently stated that, you know, you guys called to do it this way, and you're not even following your own call. I shall endeavor to go through the principal parts of the argument made use of by the gentleman in opposition to the proposed plan of government. The worthy gentleman entertained us largely on the impropriety and dangers of the powers given by this plan to the general government. But his argument appears to be inclusive and inaccurate. It amounts to this, that the powers given to any government ought to be small. I believe this, sir, is a new idea in politics. And it was a new idea in politics because they understood and grew tired of general governments or powers, you know, governments possessing general powers or all exclusive powers. Being given for some certain purpose ought to be proportionate to that purpose, or else the end for which they are delegated will not be answered. It is necessary to give powers to a certain extent to any government. If a due medium be not observed in the delegation of such powers, one of the things must happen. If they be too small, the government must molder and decay. If too extensive, the people must be oppressed. As there can be no liberty without government, it must be dangerous to make powers too limited as too great. He tells us that the Constitution annihilates the Confederation. Did he not prove that? So, okay, we'll start off in the next episode with he tells us, and that way we can quickly lean forward with the next episode and the next, you know, this next portion of the ratification debates. I hope you're enjoying this. I hope you're realizing the gold, the treasure that these ratification debates are. I'm G.R. Mobley. We're Reclaiming the Republic, and we need your help. God bless.
Folks, I'm constantly providing you with case after case and giving you both the empirical information as well as irrefutable academic evidence that the federal government is operating well outside the bounds of the Constitution. In measuring outlays, the federal government is spending over 80% of your tax dollars on unconstitutional government. This is why we don't need a balanced budget amendment. We just need to enforce the Constitution. So what is it going to take for you to take a stand in getting the federal government back into the framework of the Constitution? To be clear, the solution is simple and does not require much work on any one individual, especially if everyone contributed to the effort. We only ask that you make a commitment today to contributing however you can and make the difference necessary for our posterity's sake. Send me an email at info@reclaimingtherepublic.org and let me know how you'd like to help so we can help you save our republic.